This is Radio Free Thinker, episode 95.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Of course, also heard on CFBX in Kamloops. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher and pseudo-economist, but more on that in a bit.
And this is Chloe, member of member of UBC Freethinkers and creative writing student here at UBC.
Well, I thought my pseudo-economist was good, but what's a
professional,
linguist.
Yes,
linguist.
Of course.
No, I say pseudo-economist because our sort of economist specialist, if I can use that term loosely, Daniel, apparently for Christmas got laryngitis and can no longer talk on the show. So later on, we're going to be doing a bit of a segment that will involve some areas of economy and all that. So you're going to have to bear with me. I'm going to try and play both sides, the left and the right, which is good because we think we can do both sides.
Sure, why not?
Excellent.
I'm not sure about
Sounds
the rest
great.
Of the cast.
Well, got a great show today.
We do.
Very fantastic show, as always. And let's start things out with a bit of skeptic news. What is making skeptic news?
Well, one of the things that I thought was just interesting, because, you know, it comes up so often, is people may not know this, but there's been a bit of snow in the South.
I've heard of this.
Yes, yes. And, of course, you know, you're getting the Fox News people out there saying, this is proof that climate change is real and that we are heading for a new ice age. They said, look at all the snow, look at all the snow. But of course, this is just people who are not quite understanding the idea of climate change. Climate change means there's more energy in the system, so you tend to get more extreme events. Like, for example, I believe it's in Whistler, Washington, Mount Washington, which I think is Whistler.
Mount Whistler.
No, where's Mount Washington?
In the States.
Oh, is it?
Isn't it?
I would assume so.
It's called Mount Washington.
It's called Mount Washington.
Well, anyhow, on the news today, I saw a place where they had skiing, and the snow was so high that that people were having to get out of their second story up windows to shovel out the front doors, that it was just totally snowed in. And I'm going, see, this is what happens, because when you have more energy in the atmosphere, it can hold more water, and when it comes time to dump the water, like on the east coast of the United States, which is having a horrific snowstorm, or in the mountains or whatever, you get more snow. It's more extreme. In fact, I was listening to Democracy Right Now, and apparently, like, they've got like minus weather right now, but it's just supposed to get up to like 50 degrees by New Year's Day. This huge shift in temperatures, and part of that is, like I say, climate change. It doesn't mean things are going to get warmer or colder. They're just going to get more extreme and more fanatical. Warmer overall, but you're going to get a lot more extreme climate things.
I think it's proof of the rapture. It's coming.
Well, I mean, you know, I think part of the rapture is it predicts that there's going to be major delays at Heathrow Airport, which is going to shut down Europe travel hubs, which is also going to delay people getting to Vancouver. And from Vancouver to the UK, which is bad news for former co-host Rob. Fortunately, I actually saw him over the weekend and had a great time reminiscing about skepticism and stuff.
How was that? How is skepticism? He's originally from Poland, isn't he?
Yeah, actually he is, yes.
And he has friends and relatives from Poland.
Mm-hmm.
They had some.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to steal Rob's thunder too much, but he's blogged about this and mentioned before that he's got some family members who are a bit on the non-skeptic side, in terms of sort of creationism, anti-vax, conspiracy theories. So interesting evening discussing that with Rob and some of his family members. So fantastic day.
Well, you know, and on that note, you know, I have to confess, I saw a sign today that said 9/11 was an inside job. And I suddenly realized, I suddenly realized that's absolutely true. It has to be. I mean, the terrorists who did it were in the planes when they did the job. In fact, I would be paranoid if it was an outside job, because that means whoever did it wasn't actually in the planes at the time. So really, this whole 9/11 is an inside job just makes logical sense. I mean, they were in the plane, right?
I appreciate
so it was a job done inside. Yeah. Speaking of serious analysis, the Pope. Pope Benedict recently had some interesting things to say about the whole church scandal with regards to its children and abusing of children. And he said, and I'm going to add some dramatic license here, so bear with me. He said that the church must reflect on the church's culpability in its recent sex abuse scandal.
Pause.
Then he said, but compared to the rest of society, it really wasn't that bad that we live in a society now that really just considers the mistreatment of children as really common. And that he then went on further to say that when we look at this scandal in the broader social context, we have to realize maybe it wasn't so bad. That we live in a society which, you know, he says, child pornography is seemingly considered normal by society. I don't know where he got that from.
Who considers that normal?
And then he couples this, where drug use and sexual tourism are on the rise. Well, okay, that might be true.
Sure.
Then he says that, you know, as recently as the 1970s, pedophilia wasn't considered an absolute evil, but rather part of a spectrum of behaviors where people, you know, would use the idea of cultural relativism and tolerance with regards to it. That, and I'm quoting here, or I'm quoting him in a paper, so I wasn't there, I didn't actually talk to him. In the 1970s, pedophilia was theorized as something fully in conformity with man and even with children. He further said that it was maintained, even within the realm of Catholic theology, that there is no such thing as evil in itself or good in itself. There is only a better than or a worse than. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought the whole thing with the church and the Pope is that there is good and there's evil, and you must worship Christ and God to be a good person, otherwise you are an evil person. And if he's sort of sitting there saying, well, there's no real good or evil, it's just some people are better, some people are worse, doesn't that sort of, you know, throw away the whole moral argument from religion? And, you know, I mean, and if we do...
I believe it would, actually.
And if the Pope himself, the leader of the Catholic Church, says there's no such thing as good or evil, then you have to wonder, well, by what criteria can we, you know, accuse or judge the Catholic Church or anyone else on the concept of pedophilia or child abuse and all that? If only there was another source of information, of reason, of, I don't know, I'm just looking for that something to bring meaning to my life. Is there anything out there that can help me with this particular issue?
Well, of course, actually, Don, there is. We call it secular humanism. You know, it's funny, though, that what the Pope is basically saying here is, look, the Catholic Church failed children. And, you know, they got sexually abused. But you know what? Society was so secular and so bad that everybody was failing children. And so it's not really our fault. It's everybody's fault. And I like this line about how sexual abuse wasn't considered an evil by secular society. So you know what? I decided to look this up. And I checked the ICD-10, which is the International Statistical Classification of Diseases and Related Health Problems, 10th revision, which defines...
I'm sorry. Hmm? So you said the acronym, and you said the words.
Yes.
What is it?
It is the International Statistical Classification of Disease and Related Health Problems. I thought it was pretty obvious. It's like the DSM, only for medical problems. This is what the World Health Organization uses to classify illness.
Playing the stupid person. DSM is?
The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders.
So it's like the dictionary of what's wrong with people.
Yes, you could say that.
That a doctor would use as opposed to a layperson.
Right. So anyway, using the ICD-10, in which they define pedophilia as a sexual preference for children, boys or girls, or both, usually of pre-pubertal or early pre-pubertal age. So under this system's criteria, a person of 16 years of age or older meets the definition if they have a persistent or ongoing sexual preference for children at least 5 years younger than them. Now, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM, outlines specific criteria for the use of diagnosis of pedophilia. And these include the presence of sexually arousing fantasies, behaviors, or urges that involve some kind of sexual activity with a child, 13 or younger. Now, what's important to remember about these documents and what they say about pedophilia is that they're not moral guidelines. They are scientific parameters for defining mental and medical states. You will never find words like evil or moral listed in the definitions of these conditions. That's because they're trying to scientifically address these issues, not pass moral judgment on them. You're never going to see in the ICD, for instance, cancer classified as an evil disease, or you're never going to see AIDS classified as an immoral disease, because that's, it doesn't make any sense to classify.
It's beside the point.
Yeah.
What the purpose is here.
So, I mean, if the Pope is saying that, look, pedophilia wasn't classified as evil by secular society, well, that's because secular society is more interested in determining the scientific reality of these conditions than passing moral judgment. And again, that's typically the realm of, you know, the religious side of things. Now, I mean, the Pope is condemning a relativistic view of pedophilia, yet the Catholic Church's previous policy was to put offenders into therapy and not hand them over to law enforcement. And you're like, oh, okay, well, sure. But keep in mind that Colonel Ratzinger was the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the organization that sort of supervised claims of sexual abuse. It was his job. He was the one who put them into therapy. He was supporting the Catholic Church's policy of using a relativistic view of pedophilia. He's blaming himself without realizing it, I don't think.
Yeah, no, because you do mention, I mean, he does say that it wasn't only secular society that was viewing this. It was part of Catholic theology, or at least realm.
Which he was in charge of,
yeah.
Oh, man. And it's funny, too, how he mentions how, like, oh, you know, child sexual abuse and drug use and prostitution, they're all on the rise. It's because of secular society. Well, the thing that I have to ask here is, are they really on the rise, or are the reports of these events happening being reported more often? He could be confusing here correlation and causation. Now, I did some checking. According to Victims of Violence, a Canadian charity that works to protect and help victims of abuse, prior to 1988, the laws governing child sexual abuse did not reflect the reality of the situation. And they outlined a few couple problems here. I'm just going to mention a few of them. One of the big problems was a gender bias, in that offenses were generally only applicable to female victims and male offenders. And as we know, males can be victims of sexual abuse, and that was a big problem. Another major issue that they had was there was a limited range of sexual activity, and most of the offenses only covered vaginal intercourse. And again, there's a whole realm of ways you can sexually assault somebody that doesn't involve vaginal intercourse. Another huge problem was requirements of a previously chaste character. So girls who had previous consensual sexual experience were not considered of chaste character and were thus not really protected under these laws. Finally, there was a big problem with time restrictions, in that the offense had to be prosecuted within a year of the offense. And as you know, many victims take years to gather the courage to report their victimization.
Well, and also, I mean, if you're like a 4-year-old kid,
yeah,
How are you even supposed to know this law exists?
Right.
Let alone pursue it.
So Canada, these were rules that were on the books in Canada in 1988. These have been revised, and if you go to the website. Victims of Violence, they have an up-to-date list of new laws and what they consider to be benefits, things that still need to be worked out. Anyway, check it out. But again, you know, that was in the past here. Current laws on child sexual abuse are enforced worldwide. The United Nations passed a Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is an international treaty that legally obligates states to protect children's rights. Specifically, Articles 34 and 35 of the CRC require states to protect children from all forms of sexual exploitation and sexual abuse, which includes coercion of a child to perform sexual activity, the prostitution of children, and the exploitation of children in creating pornography. States are also required to prevent the abduction, sale, or trafficking of children. This was in the early 2000s. At a time when Europe is at its most secular, here we have a far-reaching treaty. Interesting enough, November 2008, 193 countries are bound by this treaty, including every member of the United Nations except for two, the United States and Somalia. Interesting.
Completely bizarre.
Yeah.
Going back to what you were saying earlier about talking about these scientific definitions of these things that we consider morally bad or good, is there any way to talk about them as being moral or immoral from the scientific definitions?
Well, I mean,
I like that idea, but I'm not sure if it's possible.
Well, I mean, I know for a future show we're going to be discussing Sam Harris's new book, The Moral Landscape, in which he basically makes the argument that you can make moral judgments, I suppose, are at least start the conversation of discussing morality when it comes to science. I'm certainly not suggesting that we can't label pedophiles bad or even evil, but it's not the scientific researcher's job to say this person is evil because they're a pedophile. Their job is to determine what parts of their brain make them do this sort of stuff.
I think one of the things we're running into here, too, is that at least those people of European-type descent, our language is so infused with the Christian church that there's a certain, the term evil originally meant, you know, not to do with God or to do with Satan, but we now use it in such a term as to mean something that's really, really bad or really, really harmful. But, I mean, what other word works besides evil? And, I mean, you start to struggle. And it's not that you mean to put this this religious context onto it, but you do. You want to say, well, this is something that's not good for science, is not good for people. But we struggle because the language has been so infused. The whole language of morality has become so infused with religious overtones that it's hard to separate it. I think Ethan was getting slightly there, that in the one sense we should look at this as someone who is diseased or ill or what have you and needs treatment, and then on the other side, which we haven't really gotten into, society needs a certain degree of protection from such individuals, right? And that both of these things, you know, you can call that evil if you want, and again, our language sort of forces us down that road, but I mean, we're not making metaphysical claims about their soul or anything about them.
Right.
These are more utilitarian or Kantian even sort of considerations, and I think that plays a bit of it. And I think even the Pope has missed one huge aspect to this. Ethan covered the part about pedophilia, but I mean, the Catholics' involvement, the Church's involvement in this goes beyond in two ways. One, not only were they doing these things to children, but they were also doing it, not strictly, but there was like violence involved in this. I mean, there was not only sexual abuse, but there was physical abuse of a non-sexual nature or coerced with that. And then you also have the whole idea of power. I mean, one of the things when you're a little kid and you're in a church, they say, well, if you don't do this, you're going to burn in hell forever. Ooh, scary, scary. Well, that kind of imagery. And then the priest comes to you and says, hey, if you don't do this thing I'm asking you, you're going to burn in hell. I mean, that's a power differential that's just, you know, par for none. So, I mean, above and beyond having sex with kids, there are these two other huge, huge elephants in the room that he seems to have just sort of ignored.
Yeah.
Right? In favor of saying, well, we're bad, but society's pretty crappy too, and at least we have a moral center or something. I don't know.
Well, apparently not, because they have a real...
Yeah.
Why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Free love on the free love freeway. The love is free and the freeway's long. I've got some hot love on the hot love highway. Ain't going home because my baby's gone. She's not dead.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Soundtracking your free love on the free love freeway since 1982.
Long time later, see a cowboy crying. Says, hey buddy, what can I do? Says, I lived a good life, about a thousand women. I said, well, why the tears? He says, because none of them was you. No, he's looking at a photograph.
Of you?
No, of his girlfriend. The video would have shown that, yeah.
It sounds a bit gay. Right?
It's not gay.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. So what else is making news?
Well, you know, speaking of things changing over time, when I was growing up, there were a few big mysteries. One was, where was Jimmy Hoffa buried? And another one was, whatever happened to Amelia Earhart? And I was asking a few friends of mine about this, and a lot of them said, who? And it's bizarre, because if you grew up, I mean, you know, in the last...
I know who she is, and I'm not old.
Well, you say you're not old, but we don't have your face on the... You know, she's not old. So for those of you who don't know, Amelia Earhart was a superstar aviatrix. I didn't make up that word. Apparently, this sounds naughty to me, but aviatrix from the 30s. She was really big for women's rights at that time because she was a very dominant female character. She had done a few super things with planes, and her big thing that she was going to end her career on was to go around the world in an airplane. First woman to do that. Sadly, in July 2nd, 1937, roughly, she just disappeared. She was somewhere in the Pacific, and they lost track of her. She didn't land in an Air Force. And for the next, well, almost 100 years now, they've been trying to figure out where she is. They've sent millions of dollars to try and find out about what happened to Amelia Earhart. Well, this one gentleman named Richard Giuseppe, who is executive director of the International Group for Historical Aircraft Recovery, a nonprofit. I was hoping to find some money link in here, but apparently it's a nonprofit group. Mm. But he is an author of a book called Finding Amelia. Him and his group have been searching the island of Nikumaruro Island to find evidence of Earhart. It's a tiny coral atoll about 300 miles southeast of Howell Island, which was sort of her target. That was her next stop, was to land on this thing. Now, why are they thinking, well, she might be here on this island? Apparently in 1940, the British Colonial Service discovered a partial skeleton of a castaway, and recent analysis of the notes on that body make them think, well, she could have been actually Northern European. Sadly, the bones themselves have been lost. Also, apparently, there's a whole bunch of radio signals that were heard for several days afterwards, which lead them to think that the plane had landed safely and they were trying to communicate. On the island itself, there were several parts of women's shoes, bits of makeup, a bottle that may contain hand lotion, other bottles, and a box for a sextant, which is believed to be related to the navigator who was also with them. So, you know, they thought, well, this could be it. Another thing, and this is one of the things I thought was kind of cool, they also found bird and fish carcasses that suggested, and I quote, Westerners had prepared meals here. These fish weren't eaten like Pacific Islanders eat fish. For example, someone carried shells ashore, cut them open, and then took the meat out, where apparently islanders will scoop the meat out in the water and throw the shells away while they're out there. So I thought it was weird that you could tell sort of where they were from just by the kind of carcasses. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, last spring, apparently, while they were doing some excavating of the island, they found several bone fragments, right? And one of them they think might be part of a finger. So they have taken this bone fragment and they've sent it off to the University of Oklahoma's Molecular Anthropology Laboratory. Why Oklahoma? Apparently Amelia Earhart is from Oklahoma, so they're trying to tie that in, where they're going to do a DNA extraction to see how it is. Now, Giuseppe believes that they can find the plane if only they can check the waters off this island. Apparently it's really deep waters and the tides mean it would have got pulled in, but he needs like $3 to $5 million to do this deep sea investigation, which is why I suspect this has been headline news in a bunch of newspapers, is because he's trying to gin up some reports. Because when they did an interview with the assistant professor of anthropology at the university doing the DNA test, he said, this is Cecil Lewis, he said, "Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. That's why we're trying..."
He knows about our campaign.
He does. big
point. He actually said those words?
He said, and it's a quote, "Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence." He might have also read Carl Sagan. He is an American.
Well, it's true.
But he says, you know, that's why the university is trying to downplay, you know, all the hype and all that, because honestly, it could just be a turtle bone. Yeah. Which I thought was kind of interesting. I mean, you had the hype guy, right, trying to promote his thing. It's an interesting story, you know, Western stuff, right? Well, you know, how can you tell just from looking at bones and all that? And then the science guy doing the classic, throwing a cold blanket over the whole story by saying, eh, probably nothing. Mm-hmm. But speaking of interesting, these guys are using DNA to try and find out Amelia Earhart. That's not the only way we can find out a bit of blast from the past. I hear that the King of France was discovered.
We'll get to that in a moment. What I think you were going to say is that forensics is the other way of determining if something is or is not something that is also old.
Something.
Yeah, something. Much to the relief of French monarchists everywhere, and there are a few, the head of King Henry IV has been recovered and verified as the legitimate head of the former king. So congratulations to French monarchists. King Henry IV was king of France from 1589 to 1610, considered a popular and competent king by his subjects. Henry was instrumental in ending the devastating religious wars that were raging in France at the time. This is interesting. Henry was a Calvinist, but when he became king, he converted to Catholicism and enacted the Edict of Nantes, which guaranteed religious liberties to Protestants, effectively ending the Civil War. Now, any student of history can tell you that at this time, in Europe, religious violence was very common and persecution the norm. Henry is a surprising aberration from this, as he is also known for his religious tolerance and unusual interest in the good of the people.
I am so glad that we have evolved so much that we no longer have religious conflicts or religious persecution in our society, unlike they had back then.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, he was so religiously tolerant that he was assassinated by a Catholic zealot named Francis Ravaillac in 1610. He was interred, as kings usually are. During the French Revolution, however, rioters broke into his tomb and stole his head. This was in 1793. Since then, the missing head has been passed between private collectors, and rumors that it belonged to King Henry would surface here and there, but it was never really confirmed. A journalist tracked down the head and found it in the attic of a retired tax collector. The previous owners were a French couple who apparently bought the head at a Paris auction house in the early 1900s. They then sold it in 1955 for 5,000 francs. The head was returned to the descendants of Henry, and it has since been authenticated by a team of 19 scientists and researchers. They couldn't do DNA testing. The head was simply too old and
pickled,
they...
maybe?
What's that?
Mummified, it had been too...
Yeah, they couldn't get a sample of DNA that they couldn't confirm wasn't contaminated. So they turned to forensics. And they were able to examine the monarch's head, and they would find features in his portraits that matched the skull. So they found a dark wound over his right nostril, which was featured in many of his portraits. They found a healed bone fracture above his upper left jaw, which matched a stab wound the king suffered during a previous assassination attempt in 1594, and a pierced ear that he also suffered in that attack. In addition, they were able to use radiocarbon dating, which yielded a date range between 1450 and 1650, which fitted with the king's lifespan of 1553 to 1610. And they were also able to confirm that the embalming method used was consistent with the techniques used at the time of his death. And they also compared the head to an autopsy report describing the particular embalming processes used for French kings, which was written at the time by the king's surgeon. So they're pretty confident they have confirmed that this is the head of Henry IV. I think this is actually fascinating because we were talking last week or the week before about anthropology and science. Here is a perfect example of the science-based anthropology at work doing real science. And, you know, not to kind of retread on things we already talked about, I think it's very important people realize that there's more to anthropology and the so-called soft sciences than, you know, kind of, you know, moody stuff.
You're missing the two really good parts of both of our stories.
What's that?
The gore factor. So on yours, as you point out, this isn't like a skull.
No, it
is. This is actually a head with parts and fleshy parts still attached to it.
Oh, yes,
it's kind of icky. And one of the reasons why in my story, talking about Amelia Earhart, that they haven't been able to find a lot of remains is apparently there are a lot of crabs on these islands that apparently when you die, they just pick you off and they take little parts of you back to there. So somewhere in a little crab carousel, there might be the eyeball of Amelia Earhart or some other gross part.
You know, what's also interesting about my story is that next year, France is going to hold a national mass and funeral for Henry IV, which is interesting considering France is such a, republic state. Not a big fan of the monarchs.
That's true.
Yeah.
Of course, what's good about my story is that apparently Amelia Earhart is going to be resurrected next Christmas.
Mm. Well, you know what's good about my story even more is that it segues perfectly into our next story about a new group of human ancestors.
Yes, apparently there were the plains of Earth were quite crowded with Homo-type people. And no, not the gay ones, but the genus that is ours. A 30,000-year-old... that's very mature of you. No, it's okay. So a 30,000-year-old bone was found in a cave in Siberia that apparently is related to a previously unknown group of humans that lived in the late lived a long time ago. They did DNA extraction from it, and apparently it's an entirely new branch of the human tree that is tentatively called Denisovian hominid, or Denisovians for short, which is what they've been called. Apparently this group is a sister group to Neanderthals. So they both, Neanderthals in these group, apparently about 300,000 years left Africa, and they diverged. The Neanderthals essentially staying in North America and the Middle East, and these guys going to Asia and South Asia and the Polynesian Islands and all that. And then about, just to give a timeline, about 80,000 years ago, humans left Africa, and they first interbred with Neanderthals, which is why we've had stories on our show and you've heard in the news that there's Neanderthal DNA in all human DNA outside of Africa. And then these hybrid humans apparently going to East Asia, or West Asia, China area, and they interbred with these Denisovians. And apparently that if you are of Melanesian descent, about 4 to 6%, depending on how you are, is of the DNA of these Denisovians, which really just goes to say that early humanoids were, well, I hate to use this word, sluts. They did it with anyone. Anyhow, Apparently, though, they looked quite different morphologically and genetically from human from Neanderthals and humans. They resembled, apparently, more the Homo habilis or Homo erectus. They said, well, how come we haven't found, you know, more bones if these were, you know, as big as it seems to be? And most scientists now are beginning to think that we'll have a lot of these fragments out there. They've just been misclassified. We assumed they were of Homo habilis or Homo erectus or even humans at the time. And one of the things I thought was quite interesting, that for a brief period of time, there were a lot of human-type people out there. There was Homo sapiens sapiens, which is us. There were Neanderthals. There is Homo forensis, which everyone knows is hobbit persons. There are, of course, these Denisovians. And some people even believe things like Homo erectus and Homo habilis still might have been clinging on when we were overlapping. So really, I mean, if we wonder what happened to them all, I just wonder. I guess we killed them all.
Or they died of natural causes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of cool.
Fascinating. Let's go to a commercial break on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back with more after this.
So he hid it. In one place he knew he could hide something is
CITR.
5 long years he wore this watch. Up his
CITR.
Then he died of dysentery. Give me the watch. I hid this uncomfortable hunk of metal up my
CITR.
2 years. Then after 7 years, I was sent home to my family, and now, little man, I give the watch to you.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. So, it's the Christmas season.
It is.
What happy Christmas thoughts have you got for us, Chloe, this season?
Well, frankly, I got to Christmas Day afternoon, and I was like, so what am I going to do with all the crap I got this year? I also felt that way on Boxing Day after I went shopping with my friend Holly. Anyway, December, it's spelled with an I, didn't you know? December in any country where Christmas is, you know, widely celebrated tends to be a time when people take a stance on consumerism. They do a lot of consuming over the holidays, food, stuff for presents, all the rest of it. And some people do it by making sure they give small gifts, secondhand gifts, no gifts at all. And other people go all out and make sure that everyone they know gets something new. And whether or not either side is doing it consciously, both methods of consuming imply something about whether or not the consumer feels that buying things for whatever reason is a good or bad thing to do. I doubt very many people put that much thought into it when they go out and buy a gift, but this occurred to me over the holiday season. Now, to be quite frank, I'm not really sure that either side is very well defended, but I am convinced that this is the kind of discussion that needs to take account of what is generally thought by the layperson, and, you know, then challenge it with something a little more intellectual. And the other reason that this has been occurring to me a lot recently is because as corporations become bigger and business continues to make national borders so permeable, being a responsible consumer will become as important as being a responsible citizen.
I think one of the things I loved when you brought up this topic, right, is lots of times we sit there and we think of Christmas, and one, we think of Christmas only, like, mm-hmm. you know, the 25th of December, and we say, as skeptics, as atheists or whatever, right, mm-hmm. all those religious people are crazy, they're insane, they're doing something that just doesn't really seem to make any sense. But you're bringing in that actually, you know, in spite of us trying to bring reason to the season, that there's another force that's at work here, is this whole idea of consumerism that also tends to drive people crazy. I mean, anyone who was out Boxing Day and saw the madhouse that was going on there, I mean, that was not rational spending. That was people going, it was a form of insanity akin to the religious sort of fervor. And I mean, not that I'm saying it was bad to go out and try and get a deal or try and whatever, but there is this aspect that, you know, is this rampant consumerism any worse, or is it slightly different than the same kind of irrationality you get with faith at this particular time of year? I mean, at least for the religious aspect, it's the 25th, whereas the consumerism around Christmas starts sometime in November and ends usually the first week of January or thereabouts.
Yeah, it does get pretty crazy, and I think people who take the anti-consumerism or anti-consumerist, I'm not really sure how to say it, stance, would agree with you. I mean, we often fall prey to buying things that we don't need and never use, and so they take up space in our homes or they end up in the garbage dump. And when we buy a product, we're also endorsing the way in which the product was manufactured, and the general trend is that most manufactured products tend to be bad for the environment, plastics, this sort of thing. And our purchases also provide money usually for a corporation, this is sort of like for your average thing, your phone, a music player, clothing. I'm wearing jeans that I bought on Boxing Day, so I'm a terrible example at the moment. But anyway, which concentrates wealth with a very small number of people and who own and run these corporations. And then there's also this notion of we have too many things and that we're too focused on things or experiences that we purchase as ends in themselves. And it's this last one that I sort of take exception to, because I do think that you can get quite a bit of joy out of a thing that you own, like my dolls from when I was a kid or something like that. Anyway, and so a consumerist stance would sort of say, like,
Before you go, but just to go into that, because I think one of the things when you say, you know, we have too many things, I think one of the quandaries that come into this, and this is where advertising and the idea of consumerism comes in as opposed to capitalism, is that if my identity is tied up in the things that I own. I mean, for those people who might have seen Fight Club, and they have this one great scene where they have the IKEA catalog, and they go through his room, right? And they say, I have this, and therefore I'm that, and I have this. And you're subsumed, your identity is subsumed in the things that you own. That doesn't mean you can't have things or like things or what have you that are purchased things, but there is a fine line between I cease to exist and my things I've bought become me, right? So the people who have to have the latest and greatest JPAD or something to avoid copyright item or something like that. I mean, if you want that because it's a cool toy, great. If you want that because it will somehow make you a better person or it will complete you or somehow, I think that's where this whole anti-consumerism, where it's yeah, digging at, right? And why part of the movement that you mentioned is the idea of homemade gifts, right? So you're still giving a gift. You still have that aspect of consumerism, but you're giving something that has meaning above and beyond the item in itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's even in something as what you're talking about, that notion of things defining people, is even in something as simple as when I bought the boots that I'm wearing on Boxing Day as well. I was with my friend and she said, "Oh, these boots are so Chloe." And what does that even mean? these boots are made of synthetic leather, not like out of me. So it's a very odd thing, really. Anyway, and the consumerism stance, and I'm going to mention, too, that I sort of wish Dan was here for, because he knows things about economics, but if someone else wants to jump in, that's fine. Two things that I hear a lot when people defend buying stuff is purchasing a product provides a job to the people who made that product, and then it stimulates the economy. And I totally acknowledge that these aren't economically sound, and I kind of wish that Daniel was here to explain why. Anyone else care to jump in?
Well,
In a perfect world, they would be. If Dawn, for example, made, boots, and you bought Dawn's boots, you're patroning his boot-making business. Unfortunately, the way our sort of system works, we sort of outsource a lot of the manufacturing. Well, not so much in Canada, but in the United States at least.
You haven't been to a store lately.
Quite.
Flip something over and see how much says made in Canada.
But still, I mean, Canada economy is definitely still more on the production of things. But anyway, you are providing patronage, but just to someone who is nowhere near you. And your patronage is greatly reduced by the number of hands it goes through before it gets to that person. So, in a sense, that it's still happening, but in such a minute quantity that it might not be all that useful in the first place.
Well, I think, well, so I'm going to take the first step back. The idea of stimulating the economy. Now, most economists, they're kind of schizophrenic on this, is that you need to have savings because savings provide the investment capital in order to build factories and production. But at the same time, for people who save money, it's not actually producing anything because in the sense that they're not buying stuff for the factories to produce. Yeah. So anything that can get people to empty their bank accounts or to spend their discretionable spending is a good thing. And the idea that the holiday season is a great excuse for you to buy something means that money becomes productive, whereas before it's not productive. The other aspect, as far as it, you know, providing jobs, again, you know, it's like a raise in minimum wage. It's like, you know, increasing job benefits and all that. It does. There is at least a short-term bump, which is why whenever Stats Canada and all of them do projections for job creation or whatever, they have to accommodate the fact that there is a bump at this time of the year, which means more people have more money, both spending it but also earning it. And that does actually improve the economy, at least in the short term, right? Going on with what Ethan was saying, actually, every time money changes hands, it will tend to have a multiplier effect. Actually, it actually tends to benefit each person more. And it also has, to put on my red cap here, the ability to redistribute wealth more equally. There was a study, I believe it was in a book, I can't remember the name of the book, that did some modeling and said that the more links in the chain of money, right? And this included taxation, production, sales. The more links you had, the more likely wealth wouldn't pool on individuals, but would be distributed more equally amongst the society, which is kind of a good thing, in my humble opinion.
Sure, I would agree with that. But I mean, like, in the case of, say, like an Apple product, right? You buy an iPod, the money goes to the store, but then you kind of follow that chain backwards. Does much ever get to the, you know, Chinese migrant worker who's in a factory working on it, getting paid like 2 cents an hour?
Yeah, well, two cents does. And actually, it's ironic you mention that, because one of the things China's having difficulties now is because it's become the workhorse of the world, Chinese labor is becoming more militant and not as willing to accept 2 cents a day, and they're wanting 5 cents a day. So then they're going to the Philippines or wherever the next knock on the chain is. And
right. And
that's one of the things, as this has nothing to do with consumerism, but one of the problems as Westerners we have to face is that a lot of our prosperity that we've enjoyed, our standard of living, was built upon the fact that we could extract resources from other people and make them sort of work for next to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we could pay ourselves a lot. Now, globally, things are starting to balance out, which sucks, but I mean, it's...
Well, I think that's an important point to make and does have a lot to do with consumerism, because buying something as what is now as commonplace as an iPod does endorse that kind of using labor or resources from somewhere else.
Well, I think too, and this is part of our modern society, that it's very hard for us to take. In fact, you know, maybe your grandparents or your great grandparents can deal with it. I was having a discussion before with someone about how short-lived everything is. I mean, we live in a disposable society, right? We have buildings that are designed to last 20 or 30 years, then we throw it. But other things, you know, if you go back 100 years, they were designed to last hundreds of years, right? And part of that is because in those days, you didn't have the resources to waste, or that's how they looked at it, right? I mean, now, yes, the Chinese worker gets paid 2 cents, but that means I can get a DVD player for $20. Whereas if I bought one in the 70s, right, well, they would buy a DVD player, but let's say a VHS player, which is those old tape things.
I see.
Yeah, ancient technology before recording, but it would have cost over $1,000, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the aspects of this whole consumerism and the whole, if we make more of it and people buy more of it, is things do become cheaper and you're able to, you know, have that. One of the things that's really bizarre in a way, if you think about it, one of a Christmas tradition was to get an orange in your sock. You know, for those people who have socks in their tree.
We still do that in my house, just saying.
Do you know why you get an orange?
I want to know why. Please.
Because back in the olden days, oranges were so rare and so precious, it was a huge treat to get one. Something you'd get maybe once a year, and it was put in your stocking. It would be a huge thing. Now, of course, you go, orange, you know, I mean, sure, I like the seedless mandarin oranges, and that's kind of cool. But so much of our society now we have so much crap in general, right? And that plays into the season so well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, one of the things I noticed that Chloe had on her notes that she gave us, thank you, Chloe, is that, you know, consumerism in itself, even yes, I'm going to say this, capitalism in itself is not innately bad or necessarily bad. And I may contradict myself in future episodes, so please don't hold me to this. But you, I mean, when you sit there and you have advertising, if you look at advertising from 150 years or 100 years ago, big wordy things. I mean, you look at them, they're like a novel or whatever.
Yeah.
And part of the reason was that it says, buy our product because we've got tungsten in it and it will last you 30 years. And this item was made with this and this will save you money. And it, really informative things. Boring, but informative. And then somewhere, you know, 50s is usually when it started taking heart. Buy our product because it'll make you sexy, right?
Yeah, and you have to work hard to, like, find the fine print that tells you the information that you need to know.
If you can find it at all, you know, and I mean, you know, anyone who works in a store and someone says, well, I've got product A and product B, what's the difference? And you have to say, none. You know, there's no difference, right? But one's supposed to be, you know, makes you live fast, and the other one's supposed to make you live smooth. And these are sort of meaningless terms as far as a DVD player goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, what the heck does that mean? But that's where consumerism and the whole advertising clique has shifted from informative to what they call aspirational advertising, where you're no longer trying to sell the product, you're trying to sell the dream the product
and
gives
the
you. But there's no tie to that. I mean, consumerism advertising can be informative. It's just we haven't gone down that road, and maybe that's a part of the thing as far as the consumerism of the season can be.
Absolutely, and I think that consumerism can be very responsible. There are people who make an effort to buy products that aren't environmentally wasteful, or, I mean, I know fair trade is kind of a touchy subject for some people, but are not your sort of run-of-the-mill, made-in-China type of product, and they try not to buy too many things, or things they don't, blah, 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 etc. And things, you know, as I was saying before, things can be good for one. If I want a comfortable pair of shoes, if I buy a comfortable pair of shoes, then my feet won't hurt me more. You know, like, it's something as small and sort of basic as that, you know, things that we, like, everything from, like, the apple that we want to eat to the iPod that we absolutely don't need but we're going to get a lot of happiness out of. There, I mean, that does exist, and that is a thing that we have to deal with.
Well, and that also, I mean, one of the things I have a lot of conversations with people with is, like, Scandinavia. Scandinavia, hugely atheist area.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has some of the highest church attendance. They don't go there because they're going to church or they believe in God, but it's a social thing, right? Everyone goes there, or everyone is sort of affiliated to it because it's tradition and it's part of your community, and it really has nothing to do with the religion. Anyone out there who belongs to the Church of Norway, okay, I might not be 100% accurate, please don't write me and kill me. but the idea is there. And I think one of the things I tried to push, and people who know me for a long time, I tried to refer to the holiday season as Unity Festival. Because some of the things I love about the season is how people come together and they try and share. And it's a time when you go out and you make an effort to help those that are less fortunate than you.
Mm-hmm.
When you try and show, hey, you're important to me, here's something to show you how important you are to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those things are very good and very positive. I don't think those should be tied with how much I spent on you, which kids tend to get tied up on, but kids are kids. But it, there can be a lot of good, even if it is a giving, buying, and giving of things, you know, as long as you remember that's sort of the spirit of it.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think this is just limited to Christmas. I mean, and I don't think consumerism is just limited to gift giving, but this is, I mean, this comes up a lot in December.
Yeah. Well, I mean, getting on the point of about necessity, there really is only a couple things that necessity requires of us. We need food, we need shelter, and, you know, protection from predators, other humans, society to defend us, right? I mean, if you think about what Christmas gifts you got this year, fulfill those requirements. Maybe you got a sweater, maybe you got like a bottle of wine, that's kind of food. But, you know, if you got an iPod, or if you got new boots, or you got, you know, something a bit more crazy like a DVD player, yeah, that doesn't really make your necessity more likely to survive. But it can affect you in other ways. Having a smartphone can increase your productivity in many different areas of your life. Having new boots, like you said, can make you your feet more comfortable, but you can run faster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because something isn't necessary for your survival or even functioning your day-to-day activity doesn't mean you can't augment your ability to function better with other gifts,
or
right?
Augment like your social ability.
Well, and I think the one thing that an iPod, even if it's something that I can't conceivably think of any way that feeds me, protects me, whatever, the other aspect is, again, the sense of belonging.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
We are social animals. We need to feel connected to people. It's part of how we work. And if you give a gift, irrespective of the usefulness of that gift, the mere fact that it was given gives it a certain degree of usefulness.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm just kind of thinking back of some other famous gifts. What use is frankincense?
I think it was meant to be tributary in some way.
I thought frankincense, because frankincense, was that the embalming one or the perfume? Because one of them was once perfume.
So, and the myrrh is the
used for embalming.
Yeah.
So, but frankincense had a lot of use, because if you didn't have a lot of showers, and from what I understand, indoor plumbing wasn't big back then. Perfume had
value. That's a forethinking gift. That's like...
Well, it's a nice way of sitting there saying... Yeah, nice way of sitting there saying, you stink, but I'm not going to say it. Have some perfume.
Interesting. Well, we're running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so why don't we move on to our skeptical highlights? And there's really only one skeptical highlight that I can think of, but maybe others can think of more. That is the last Skeptics of the Pub, which is going to be on Thursday the 30th.
Last ever?
No,
Skeptics
of this month.
Of the pub?
Skeptics in the pub. This is Skeptics of the Pub?
You said Skeptics
of
the Pub.
Well, whatever.
when we're there, we'll be of the pub.
Sure, of course. We will be of the pub. Thursday the 30th at Legends Pub in Richmond. It's just a few minutes away from the SkyTrain station there, so come on out. They've got some great food, great drinks, good old time with your fellow skeptics. Last time in 2010. Aw, what a nice year.
I hope everyone is getting their New Year's Eve resolutions ready, because as we know, the magical date of January 1st, where everything changed because of pixie dust that comes from the cosmic space.
You know what else you can get ready for 2011? Predictions.
Quite.
Yes.
For example.
You know, I think there's going to be a series of earthquakes in 2011, potentially devastating earthquakes.
And I suspect in the United States, there will be a huge political scandal that will see a potential presidential candidate thrown out of that particular chance of becoming president.
Interesting.
That's very ominous. I predict that December 31st of next year, the world is going to end. That is what I predict.
2012,
no! The Idiot's Survival Guide to 2012 is available in bookstores near you. I saw it when I was out Christmas shopping.
Cool. Did you buy it for someone?
I did not buy it for someone, unfortunately, because I'm lying. I don't believe that that's going to happen. But on the topic of New Year's resolutions and consumerism, a couple of years ago, made the New Year's resolution to not buy clothing for a year, and I did it. So for any of our female listeners who buy too much clothing, or even some of our male listeners, it is doable. You should do that.
You know, Chloe, at the end of it. With a sexist comment like that, I'm not sure if we're going to even have you on the show in the new year.
Well, it's funny you mention that. I'm not coming back because I don't like you.
Hey, Christmas wishes do come. No. No, actually, in the new year, we're not quite sure how things are, but Chloe may not be a regular on her show because her academic pursuits may make it difficult for her to show up at this particular time to do our live show. We still hope to hear from Chloe from time to time, and who knows, we may rearrange the mechanics of our episode to keep her on the show. Anyone who has any comments or a goodbye or hello or thank you to Chloe should send it to radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
That's a good point.
Anyone who's getting prepared for hopefully our next episode, if I get things together, might want to read Sam Harris's The Boundaries of...
Moral Landscape.
Thank you.
That book you're talking about.
Yeah, well, you see, when you listen to an audiobook, you never actually look at the cover, so it's hard to do that. But we're hoping to delve into, can science shed light on moral and ethics, and can there be good and evil in the science realm?
Oh, boy.
So stay tuned next week. In the meantime, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, reminding you to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and visit our webpage at www.radiofreethinker.com.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Chloe saying goodbye, and you will see everyone next year.
Bye-bye, everybody.